History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. One of the worst natural disasters of the 20th century was the Great Bola Cyclone. It was about the size of Texas, and it hit the coast in the low-lying areas of what is now Bangladesh, creating a 20-foot storm surge. The only survivors were people who could climb up to the tops of palm trees and hang on for dear life. Once it was over, 500,000 people would be dead. But that wasn't the end of the story. The cyclone caused a chain reaction of cascading catastrophes that ended up flipping a democratic election in the country of Pakistan, led to a genocide, which left 3 million people dead and is barely remembered today, all the way up to a nuclear brinksmanship between the American and Soviet navies, and the two superpowers were probably about an hour away from launching nuclear weapons around the world. Once it was all over, Pakistan became two countries, Pakistan and Bangladesh. In today's episode, we're going to look at how major political change and even revolution isn't always man-made or even usually man-made, but how it can be triggered by natural disaster. I'm joined by Scott Carney and Jason Miklian, authors of the book The Vortex, a true story of history's deadliest storm, an unspeakable war, and liberation. Pakistan was split into East Pakistan and West Pakistan at the time, and East Pakistan was almost ruled like a colonial fiefdom by the West. A West Pakistani general ruled the country, but was promising a free election, which was scheduled 2 weeks after the storm. The ruling general dropped by East Pakistan to look around after the storm, flying over the devastation, but then just went home, and he did almost nothing for them. In fact, one of his generals said that the storm solved 500,000 problems, meaning they were glad that 500,000 people wouldn't vote against them in the election. But it didn't turn out that way. East Pakistanis voted so hard against the West Pakistanis that the colonial possession basically had power over the colonizer. This led to Pakistani President Yahya Khan ordering his army into East Pakistan, starting a horrific genocide, leveling the city of Dhaka, killing political leaders, killing students, killing intellectuals, and in the end, murdering 3 million people. So what we're going to see in this episode is how small unrelated events can snowball not just into national revolutions, but international ones or even global war. Hope you enjoyed this discussion with Scott Carney and Jason Miklian. We usually don't think of storms or cyclones as being the catalyst of a revolution or a massacre or some sort of massive change in government. Usually we imagine that it's a man-made occurrence. For example, the British are taxing our stamps too much, which leads to the American Revolution. The French aristocrats are too aloof from the concerns of commoners, leading to the French Revolution. But in the case of your book, a cyclone triggers a revolution, or perhaps it lays bare the divisions that were there to begin with. Before we get into the details of the story, and there's a lot to get into, why do you think most people don't consider nature or natural disasters as being a player when it comes to political change?
I mean, that's really interesting because I think you hit the nail on the head. We like to think that humans cause their own fate from happening, right? We like to think that there's a narrative of politics that leads inextricably from one thing to another. But we don't, I guess, like knowing that major climactic events affect us. You know, things like, you know, a river moving and the Indus Valley civilization destroys that civilization. We like to think that those politics were you know, just as relevant, but you know, we are natural creatures and we are affected by these things that are a lot larger than us.
Well, there's a lot to go to into the story, and I suppose we need to set up the context since most aren't aware of Pakistan. If they know anything about it, they might know the partition after the independence of British India. But as a way to enter into the Pakistan situation in 1970, before the cyclone made landfall, or more specifically, the situation between East and West Pakistan, could you describe its political and social conditions, the ethnic tensions between Punjabis and Bengalis? And the way you do this in the book is you don't just describe it, you weave it through different stories, and in particular, the story of a soccer star who later becomes a soldier, Hafiz Uddin Ahmad. So could you please describe that?
Yeah, so imagine this. Hafiz Uddin Ahmad is the Pele of Pakistan. He is the best soccer player. He even wears Pele's number on his back. And he is standing in a stadium of 20,000 roaring fans playing against the Soviet Union's national team, and he is there for the national team of Pakistan. And as he gets the ball, he's charging these Soviet defenders, he's weaving through them, and every time he catches the ball, it is just this enormous eruption of just joy that he is doing so well. And he kicks the ball over to another player, a Punjabi from the other side of Pakistan, and then that crowd falls dead silent. When he gets the ball again from that player, the crowd erupts again. And what's going on is that Hafez is playing. He is a Bengali player playing in the Bengali capital of Dhaka, while Pakistan is a divided country with an east and a west wing. What we think of now, what is now Bangladesh, was then East Pakistan. And it was ruled as a colonial sort of fiefdom from on the other side of Pakistan. And it is playing out right here on the field as he's going in. And he's playing against the global superpower of the Soviet Union, which is nominally an enemy of Pakistan. As he runs towards the goal, he gets this tie goal at the halftime. And it just seems like there's this chance for the true underdog to win everything all at once. We go into halftime, and what happens then is that he's sitting there. There's this sense of excitement as the student union leaders of a political party called the Awami League, which is a Bengali nationalist party, come in and then demand that they field only Bengali players in the second half of this game. And Hafez, when he hears that, he knows that they are doomed because, you know, you need your best players when you're playing one of the best teams in the world. His coach fights it, but at the end, they say that they're going to riot if they cannot field Bengali players. So they go out on the field, they kick the ball, and it's a flop at the second half. And this is sort of what sets up the entire narrative of the vortex, because Hafez also realizes that as he's on the field, it is actually going to be the last soccer game he plays, even though he's the most popular soccer player in the entire country. He is done because his father, who's a politician for that same political party on the low-lying island of Bola, says that he wants his son to get a real job. You know, quotes around that. You think of every father being like, oh my God, why is my son doing the sports stuff? And Hafez has been looking around trying to figure out what he wants to do with his life, and an army major from the army's national team, you know, comes over to him and says, you know, Hafez, I know that you're thinking about leaving soccer, but I have an offer for you. I want you to take a real job with the Pakistan military because we are this unifying force in Pakistan. It's a real job and you get to play soccer for the rest of your life. And, you know, Hafez mulls it over and, you know, after some consternation decides, yeah, he'll join the army and he'll get involved. And so we see this transition from Hafez going from popular soccer star to soldier. And then as we, you know, as the book progresses and as these cataclysmic storms occur, the tensions of East and West Pakistan play out in his life reluctantly through the whole time, so that when the cyclone hits and decimates his island, he goes out with the relief effort and starts burying the hundreds of thousands of people who were killed in that cyclone. He is leading one of those operations where he meets this drunken president named Yahya Khan, who does not care a lick about the Bengalis because he is from the other side of Pakistan. And he is from Islamabad, and these Bengalis mean nothing to him. In fact, he likes the fact that 500,000 people die because that means there's 500,000 fewer votes voting against him in the upcoming elections, which happen only 2 weeks away. And as one thing leads to another, and I'm sure we're going to get into all of those details here, Hafez again has to make this decision as, you know, there is this moment where Yahya Khan starts deciding to overturn the results of election and commits a genocide and starts killing every single Bengali who is armed, every artist, every politician, every person who opposes him and has the power to oppose him. And Hafez needs to make this decision while he's leading a Bengali unit, is how he is going to resist when the Baluchi and the Punjabi regiments demand that the Bengalis surrender their arms.
Jason, can you describe some of the ethnic tensions between Punjabis and Bengalis that will help us make sense of what happens next? Because particularly for an American audience, when we hear about a part of the world where people are of the same religion, it's easy to assume that because they're brethren, there shouldn't be division between them, which, I mean, as an aside, tell that to people in Northern Ireland in the 1970s. But could you give us some context, and what do we need to know that would explain what will happen next? Why a, for example, a Punjabi would consider a Bengali perhaps not as much of a Muslim, and other tensions that are important to understand here?
Sure. And great. And thanks so much for having us on, too. I think that one of the important things that we can think about here is that the background of this story, of these tensions, really begins all the way back in partition, when England gave up its crown jewel of India. You know, as we all know, the subcontinent was divided across religious lines, where the Hindu majority provinces became India and the Muslim majority provinces became Pakistan. But the problem, of course, was that the two different sections of Pakistan were separated by nearly 1,000 miles. You had to the west, the Punjabi Urdu speaking West Pakistan, and to the east, you had the Bengali speaking East Pakistan. Now, even though East Pakistan had more people, it was much poorer, and the West tended to use it just as a place where they could extract valuable resources. So over 20, 25 years, it perpetuated this notion that West Pakistan was where the money and where the power was, and East Pakistan was effectively the colonial territory of the West. So over an entire generation, this, of course, built up a lot of resentment and a lot of tensions between West and East. And it was all exacerbated by the fact that their sworn enemy, India, lay in between them.
That helps a lot. Thank you. And these tensions, although it could perhaps be held together by a strong government, the problems are laid bare with natural disaster, and which we'll come to. Tell me about the cyclone itself. How big was it, and what was it like for survivors to live through it?
Sure. So this was a sort of warm water-fed cyclone that came up through the Bay of Bengal in an area that had traditionally been hit by many, many cyclones before, including ones that had killed hundreds of thousands of people. And, you know, imagine it's about the size of Texas. And the first thing that happens is it sinks an Indian freighter, which gives notice to the Indian government that they know a big storm is coming. But we are just on the cusp of satellite imagery, where it starting to get good. We have the very first like television quality broadcast coming down to Earth. And the systems are not yet developed to really send warnings out correctly to these populations. And although it is not the strongest storm of the season, it's not a category 5, it's a category 4. It happens to hit during a full moon at high tide. And when you think about the country of East Pakistan, what is now Bangladesh, it's a place that, you know, a lot of the landmass along the coast is barely a meter above sea level. And when that storm hits at about 11 at night, when it starts coming in, you know, people are getting ready for bed. They hear these sort of confusing storm warnings, and the surge goes up to about 20 feet. And we have this this person named Muhammad Hai, who we found who survived the storm. And he's, you know, at first they hear the warnings, and they hear their cows and their livestock getting upset outside, and the water starts creeping into their house. And they're like, oh my God, this is really bad. We should have sought higher ground if we could have. But that by then it's too late. The water fills the first floor of his house. It fills the second floor of his house. And he has to jump to the roof of the building with his, I think about 20 family members with him. And they're all screaming. They don't know what's going on. They don't know when it's going to abate. And they're praying to God that it will be all right. And and Muhammad Hai realizes that his only chance is to jump to a palm tree about 5 feet away from his house. And he does it and climbs to the top and holds on in 140 mile an hour winds. And he calls to his family, say, you guys need to jump too. You guys need to jump too. And he just calls out into the night, and no one else jumps. And he hangs on for about 8 hours in this sort of swaying palm tree. And the next morning he finds his entire family dead. He buries 100 people in his yard the next day. And his island of 50,000 people has a 90% fatality rate, where, you know, everyone is dead. And the storm actually kills 500,000 people in East Pakistan at that time.
It's a tragedy for multiple reasons, because as you mentioned, people are right at sea level. Also, Bangladesh today has one of the highest population densities in the world. A bit of trivia is that there are more people living in Bangladesh than Russia. Even though Russia is the largest nation on Earth, Bangladesh, I don't know if there are any oblasts in Russia that are as small as Bangladesh, and it has more people. So not to use a cliche, perfect storm, but really everything terrible that would have made for a disaster, it seems like it's present here in Bangladesh that would have made it horrific, if I understand correctly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was, you know, the perfect storm was, you know, the title we probably should have chosen for the book, but I think Sebastian Younger already got it. is that this, it really hit in at a moment which where a moment in time where the most, the highest number of people were vulnerable. There were no warnings. But I think even more importantly, it also hit at a moment in time which was incredibly politically fragile. And this is what you were getting at the top of this show, is that when that storm smashed into the coast, the casualties weren't only the 500,000 people and the villages and the livestock and the food resources, but it was actually the political system that was hit by that storm as well, and the fallout that sort of inextricably and inevitably led from one domino to another, where first there's sort of an election that gets changed, there's a response to an election, that election there, and it leads all the way, believe it or not, to a very tense nuclear standoff between the Soviet Union and the United States of America.
You mentioned earlier General Yahya Khan and his response after the cyclone. Could you elaborate more on that? And also him in general, he sounds like a little miniature Idi Amin with how cruel he is, yet also how buffoonish.
No, absolutely. I think that's a great example. I mean, so Yahya Khan was a World War II war hero for the Indian Army, which was ruled by the British. It was a British Indian Army. And he fought the Nazis. He was captured as a POW and actually lived the high life in a Nazi concentration camp, where he actually had this sort of weird admiration for the Nazis while he was there. And, you know, eventually he sort of climbs through the ranks after World War II and becomes appointed the president of Pakistan by this corrupt military leader who named Ayub Khan, who did not want to get deposed in a coup. So he gave the position to Yahya Khan and said, Yahya, what you need to do first and foremost is make Pakistan a free and fair democracy, which is a weird thing for a dictator to say, but I think he was trying to save his face and his life once he was out of power. And Yahya Khan took that mission to heart. And he, you know, not only built the capital city of Islamabad in actually a really uncorrupt way, but he also put in the infrastructure for a free and fair democratic elected system, you know, the admiration of the world. And he figured that because he was so good at this, that everyone would vote for his political party. And so when this storm happens, they had this election scheduled for 2 weeks later. And he was weirdly out in China doing a mission for President Richard Nixon. You know, probably everyone who listens to this podcast knows that Nixon's major diplomatic international feat was opening up relations with China. Well, he was able to do that because Yahya Khan was both Nixon's best friend and had very good relationships with China. So he was this undercover emissary going back and forth to China on behalf of Nixon, even at one point smuggling Kissinger into China on a private airplane. And he's there when this storm hits. Yahya Khan also has this vice, which is he is a like outrageous alcoholic and an outrageous womanizer with just this litany of affairs. And he just drinks all the time. And he is like basically debauched when the storm hits. He gets word that 500,000 people have died in his, you know, his low-lying regions of East Pakistan. He more or less just shrugs and doesn't care. And the subsequent aid response is so horrendously bad that it becomes this organizing and galvanizing electoral issue among the Bengalis, who were already upset about the West Pakistani rule. And where Yahya Khan initially expected a divided vote in East Pakistan, where all the Bengali different parties with their different ideologies were going to just like vote in like 10 different parties, what actually happened is they all united behind this one leader named Sheikh Mujib Rahman, the Awami League, which is the name of the party. And the vote went so seriously to the direction of the Bengalis that it was about the equivalent of the Democrats getting 90% of the vote in America and the Republicans with just 10, except that Yahya Khan was in power. And so when this happens, he says, oh, my, okay, you know, this election was bad. He starts blaming the fake news media. He starts blaming, you know, this crazy, you know, he starts putting out conspiracy theories into the world, and he does not want to give up power. And he gaslights Sheikh Mujib all the way to the constitutional last second, basically inauguration day, And on that day, he launches something called Operation Searchlight, where he has flown in Pakistani troops from Islamabad and Karachi, and they all are in Dhaka, which is the East Pakistan capital. And on that day, he basically makes the Awami League illegal. He kicks it out of power, and he starts massacring everybody he can. And his famous quote at this point is, "All I need to do is kill 3 million of them, and the rest will eat out of my hand."
We'll definitely come back to this, but I'd be remiss if I didn't look at the friendship between Yahya Khan and Richard Nixon. Because on the one hand, I mean, it sounds very strange where the secretive, sweaty, nervous politician Nixon is friends with what appears to be a tin pot dictator in the making. And it's hard not to psychoanalyze there, but why are they such close friends, do you think?
So Nixon had this very strange appreciation of Pakistan that goes back to his days when he was in Congress, where he actually visited Pakistan early on in his career and made friends with the Pakistanis. And for some reason, and I wish I knew what was going on in his head, because it's very difficult to know, but he just really hated the Indians. He hated Indira Gandhi, who was the president of India at that time. And he, you know, I think maybe another thing that had happened is that Pakistan was an American ally from sort of a military perspective, from a strategic perspective, and India was a Soviet ally from sort of that Cold War logic. And so even though they were both not only democracies, Nixon just always preferred the Pakistanis. There's just so many quotes where he's saying things on the equivalent of like, the Pakistanis are just good people, and those Indians, you just can't trust them. And it was maybe just racism, but they, because, you know, Nixon was a strong man, Yahya was a strong man, I think that just strong men attracted one another. And they also had this sense that they could do business. They could do covert deals where other people were maybe more interested in transparency.
Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. But first, I want to give a shout out to all the other great shows on the Parthenon Podcast Network, including Beyond the Big Screen. And you can find this and many other great shows at ParthenonPodcast.com. I'm trying to find, I don't know, an example or an analogy in the United States. One that came to mind, and tell me if this is correct or not, would be after the Civil War. If the South, it were, you know, not under Union control and occupation, were somehow able to so overwhelmingly vote for the Democratic Party that they would win the election, even though at this time they were subordinate to the North. They were the sort of the junior partner in the two sides.
I mean, I don't know what your political situation is, but I see very serious parallels to what happened with the Trump presidency recently, right? You know, we have an election that goes, you know, it's a narrow election, but it goes firmly over to Biden. And then Trump does everything he can to try to turn the election in the other way. And people can see that this is what looks like a very corrupt process as it goes. There's even an insurrection. It just so happens that Trump is maybe not enough military minded or doesn't have like enough total control over the infrastructure of the, again, the military.
So basically I was asking, all you can start it on whenever you want, that how is operations? So can you describe Operation Searchlight, but then at the time, how is it justified by the government? Because to do something so atrocious, you have to effectively demonize the other side, which they did because they were able to conduct this operation. So what happened, but how is it justified?
You really see this sort of nascent Islamic fundamentalism really getting played out in a rhetoric. Now, at that time, Pakistan was actually had a sort of more liberal vibe to it than it does now or, you know, 10 years ago. But what happened is that they realized that they could activate the sort of young soldiers, and Yahya Khan brought in his generals alongside the clergy, all of these different mullahs. And they, right before the soldiers would get on an airplane from Islamabad to Dhaka, they would give them an hour-long sermon about how the Bengalis were all fake Muslims, how the Quran allows you to rape and murder people who are idolaters, who are, he would call them Hindus. And it was a really this like impassioned, just totally false version of Islam that was preached in order to simply radicalize people against the Pakistani soldiers, these 18-year-old infantrymen and whatnot, against the Bengalis. And so when they actually got on the airplane, you know, they don't speak the same language. They don't know Bengali, right? These people speak Urdu, they speak Punjabi, Pashto, and these other languages. And so they, these soldiers just land in a country where they just know everyone is bad. And also sort of, you know, the skin complexion of people in Bangladesh is generally darker than the skin complexion of people in Pakistan. And that led sort of these other sort of racist tropes where they would call Bengalis black dogs. They would complain about their effeminate diet. And once you had, you know, really gotten these 18-year-olds on board with totally looking at their own countrymen as monsters, it was very easy for Yahya to say, you know, I want the land, not the people.
Can you tell me about other figures in this book? What are they doing before, during, after the massacre? One is a Bengali revolutionary named Muhammad Hai.
So Muhammad Hai is this just 18-year-old kid who grows up in this island of Manpura, which is just a sort of a forgotten area of Bangladesh, maybe somewhat strategically important in terms of shipping and trade, since every ship needs to go by it. But he just wants bigger things in life. And, you know, he wants to study at Dhaka University, the Harvard of East Pakistan. And he is just looking for sort of a way up and a way out. You know, he loves soccer. And then when we have this storm come in, you know, he'd lived through storms before. He wasn't too worried about it. But as that water rose and rose and rose and decimated his family, killed all 20 family members who were in his house and 90% of the island, he gets swept up into the need to start helping people. So his first action after the cyclone is to bury 100 people in his front yard and then search among the survivors to start creating a very grassroots aid network. You know, who has any food left? Let's go collect this all in one place. And he actually takes a position that's more important than the mayor of his little township, who has basically catatonic and abandoned his post because he can't deal with the horror. As we sort of proceed forward in time and in the book, that it becomes clear that the aid that's coming in, that's promised from the government, is never arriving. And he teams up with Candy Rhodey, who's this Bostonian aid worker who also just answered the call. She was a housewife the day before the cyclone. And then the cyclone hits, she's like, I have to do something. And so she, Hai, and John Rhodey, her husband, all start sort of just cobbling together aid. And because the government is so bad, that private aid network becomes one of the most powerful aid delivering civilian aid relief efforts in global history. And it looks like they're actually doing a pretty good job. They're getting millions of dollars and thousands of tons of food and relief supplies. When Yahya Khan, the election flips and Yahya Khan's like, forget this. We don't want the Bengalis anymore. And Muhammad Hai transforms from an aid worker into a revolutionary, you know, trying to get training in India. He goes over into India trying to get to learn how to use a gun with a group of four other people. And although he doesn't make it across the border, some of his friends do. And he comes back to the island. And when his friend eventually returns with, you know, some grenades and some guns, he becomes a major logistical officer, helping use actually the same tactics he learned for distributing aid to instead moving soldiers around that area and harassing and harrying the Pakistani military, who's, you know, on a genocidal rampage.
We know that West Pakistan was not grafted back into East Pakistan as an obedient subordinate member of their coalition, if you want to call it. What happens in the aftermath of Operation Searchlight that leads to Bangladesh?
So, you know, naturally, just like we see in Ukraine right now, no one wants to live in a war zone, right? No one wants to be a target. So as many people who can try to flee to India. And if you can just think about what the outline of India is, there's this little arm coming off of its east side. It wraps 3/4 of the way around East Pakistan, what is now Bangladesh. And there's only this tiny little border with Myanmar, and then you have the Bay of Bengal on the south. So pretty much all Bengalis that could fled into India, and they just swamped Calcutta. You know, at least 3 million refugees. I don't think there's actually ultimately an accurate count of how many people came over. And India, you know, just like, you know, America, when we have sort of climate migrants coming across our southern border, we're not too excited. We're not excited about just having to deal with hundreds of millions of dollars of aid relief that they're going to have to give to this group. And so what Indira Gandhi does, who was already, you know, Indira Gandhi hates Pakistan. India had just fought a war 5 years earlier against Pakistan. And she starts arming the militants. You know, the few Bengali military units that were able to flee got training in Indian bases. Indira Gandhi is a Soviet ally. So India brings in Soviet artillery, Soviet tanks. So, you know, all this Soviet material, machine guns, bullets come in from the Soviet Union, and they end up funding and completely training something called the Mukti Bahini, literally freedom fighters. And as we sort of march forward in time, after about a year of preparation, being sure that the ground is solid, that there's going to be a good invasion plan, ultimately East Pakistan, the Pakistan military, while pretty well trained, you could say, has nowhere near the numbers of the Indian military. And the Indians launch over the border after Operation Searchlight, after this stuff. And they, you know, with the aid of the freedom fighters, are able to you know, get up to the very gates of Dhaka without really any trouble.
In the aftermath of Operation Searchlight, there are those seeking revenge, some specifically against Yahya Khan. One of them is his mistress. Can you tell me about this episode? This is very interesting.
Right. So again, Yahya Khan is this debauched dictator, drunken, lecherous, and he's trying to sleep throughout this entire event. He's trying to sleep with all of the Bengali starlets. Sorry, the Bengali starlets and the Pakistani starlets, the sort of also the B-list celebrities who want their careers back. They realize that their way back into the spotlight is through Yahya's bed. And one of them is this woman that he calls Black Beauty, who he met at a party. And she is Bengali. She is sort of in that sort of literati circles. And their affair, you know, when they first meet up, he basically disappears for a week from the international scene. All of his responsibility he shirks so he can sleep with this woman. And on the eve of the war with India, what has actually happened is that his son, Ali, has actually a similar taste in women. And his Ali seduces, or maybe Black Beauty wanted to get back at Yahya Khan because she herself was Bengali, but she sleeps with Yahya's son. And Yahya discovers this and he shows up at the hotel room with a revolver in his hand and threatens to kill his son that day. I mean, you can't even believe that this is happening. What sort of Oedipal craziness is this? And, you know, it descends into like just chaos. Eventually, you know, Yahya just disowns his son right on the spot. He sleeps with Black Beauty and then comes back to his house and orders the strike, an airstrike on India, which he imagines in his drunken state is going to be sort of like the Six-Day War in Israel. He's going to overwhelm India with his massive air superiority. But where Israel had a tremendous number of very high-tech jets, he has sort of these dilapidated air force. And he strikes like 7 bases in India and does like 0 damage, which is, you know, put some potholes and runways. But that is the excuse that India needs to declare its war on Pakistan. So it was like the biggest military blunder you can imagine, sparked by this almost cuckold situation.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. Real piece of work. He sounds like a mixture of Harvey Weinstein meets Caligula meets, I don't know, Game of Thrones. So I've looked at a lot of debauched, mentally ill world leaders, but he sounds like he is really jockeying for a high place. He maybe didn't have enough power to reach the top of the list, but all the character attributes are there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he definitely needs to be on a top 10 list somewhere.
Absolutely. Well, this incident with India, this escalates, and you had mentioned nuclear brinksmanship between America and the Soviet Navy. So how does this attack on India lead to that?
Well, again, I had mentioned earlier that Yahya Khan was the link, the critical link to opening up diplomatic relations with China. And in return for that, for him helping Nixon, Nixon promised American weapons, American arms, American logistical support in whatever Yahya needed in its fight against India. And this also meant that it was American bullets, American planes, American tanks that were committing the genocide of 3 million people in East Pakistan at the time. And while the American embassy was putting up the flag and being like, oh my God, there's a genocide happening, we have to stop this, Nixon covered all of that up. And he basically fired everyone who wanted to raise alarm against it. So that when the war ultimately happens, America is on Pakistan's side. We're not on the side to stop the genocide. We are on the side of like, no, let's keep this tin pot dictator in power. So after Yahya's horrendously stupid strike on India, he suddenly realized that he's going to lose this war, right? India just surges over his border. He's like, oh my God, they're actually bombing on his side of Pakistan too. Karachi is getting bombed. All of the oil fields in Karachi are now lit on fire. And he phones up Nixon and says, look, I need help. I need you to come in. I need to start another front in this war. And, you know, to our great disgrace as Americans, we do. We send in the USS Enterprise over from Vietnam, which is raging right now. And it comes into the Bay of Bengal, and India is suddenly aware that we have this nuclear strike carrier with orders to destroy the Indian Air Force coming into the Bay of Bengal. And it calls up its ally, the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union sends down a missile attack cruiser fleet plus a submarine fleet from Vladivostok. And they cut off the Americans, and they form this arbitrary line of control in the Bay of Bengal, where if the Americans are to pass this sort of this latitudinal point, the Soviets must destroy the USS Enterprise, the pride of our fleet. And at this point, as we get this sort of tense nuclear standoff, Henry Kissinger tells Nixon that this could be our ground zero. This is the time where we might need to start launching nukes. He says, start lobbing nukes, and especially if they cross this arbitrary line of control. So what the Soviet commander, Krugliakov, does is he wants to sort of tell the American captain of the Enterprise how dangerous this actually is. So he does the stupidest strategic move that a submarine fleet can do. And he surfaces three subs in front of the Enterprise, okay? So, you know, within visual sight, which is not what you want to do if you're a sub commander and you're about to go to war. You don't surface your subs in front of the enemy, but they actually just form like a roadblock in front of the Enterprise. And Tissot's orders, the captain of the Enterprise's orders, are to continue steaming over to Bay of Bengal, get to Dhaka, and start fighting. And you don't know which way it's going to go at this point, because we're about an hour from possibly World War III. But the reason it doesn't occur is because those freedom fighters, the Mukti Bahini, who were armed by India, trained by India using Soviet weapons, end up taking Dhaka. That city falls, and now there's no reason to fight.
I'm curious why this genocide isn't remembered. And when a major historical event isn't part of common knowledge, there's a number of explanations. Perhaps another narrative has crushed it and revisionist historians are trying to recapture it. Other times, it's simply not convenient for any of the relevant parties to remember. An example is China's involvement in World War II. America doesn't really acknowledge it because now we're distant from each other. China itself, much of it was not fought by Mao, but Chiang Kai-shek. So because it's not really helpful for anyone to remember it, their major contributions, equal to that of the Russians of those lives lost, has been mostly forgotten. I wonder why this genocide has been forgotten. Is it really because for the relevant parties, there's no real reason to celebrate or remember except for perhaps Bangladeshis?
Well, Bangladeshis certainly remember. This is their revolutionary war, and they are equally baffled as you are as to why the world isn't still talking about it. I think there's a couple factors, especially in America, which is that, one, we like to be the heroes, right? We don't want to be the people who come in on the side of a genocide. Nixon wants to be remembered for his efforts in China, right? He wants to be remembered for these other macro events that are happening that are actually very positive for him. And also, we're raging in the middle of the Vietnam War at this time, where actual Americans are being shot and killed in a war. And I think that maybe there's just battle fatigue among American population, where there's just so much going on and that the stakes just don't seem as important. You know, obviously, the standoff between the two nuclear strike forces is not broadcast around the world at that time, right? No one wants to say, well, we almost all died yesterday, right? That doesn't make the papers until, you know, the historical record bears it out much later. So I think it's that confluence of factors where, you know, this sort of part of the world that most Americans didn't really know about anyway, many American lives were lost, that it's easy to just sort of forget. But what we're really trying to do in the book, and I think that we succeed in this, is to show how interconnected the world actually is, and that how when you have conflicts in parts of the world that you never even dreamed about, right? You never had any thoughts about. Those things can spiral out of control when that sort of international web of alliances and capital and resources all sort of come together and start inextricably pulling you into them.
To tie these different threads together, I'd like to come back to the question we began with, and that's how climate change can affect major world events.
Right.
What do you think this story tells us about how humans react in the face of climate emergencies, and what lessons should we take from this going forward?
So in the vortex and with the Bengali liberation, it all began because of a storm. Like, the storm was the catalyst for undergirded political situations that were already existing. You know, at some point, East Pakistan may have erupted into a revolution, right? Maybe a vote would have happened and a different president might have been in office, and it would have actually gone a different, maybe less violent way. But what these catalyst points do is suddenly take a situation that might be just merely unstable to all the way to dangerous or even catastrophic. And it's sort of like this black swan event that you never know what's going to happen. And although we cannot say that the Bola cyclone was caused by climate change, it may have just been a bad storm, right? You know, we don't have the scientific data or even epistemological devices to understand what climate change causes on an individual level. But we can say that these storms, when they land into political systems, are a roll of the dice. You know, you don't really know how this chaotic element is going to change things down the line. And with climate change, with a warming world, we're fairly certain that we're going to get stronger and more powerful storms around the world more frequently. So if every storm is a roll of the dice, what we're doing is we're rolling the dice more and more often in more parts of the world. And I think that's what that's the hidden picture. You know, we usually think that climate change is like, oh, we're going to have some sea level rise. You know, maybe Miami is going to get inundated. You know, we're going to have some food problems. There's going to be some desertification. And we keep those discussions on the sort of environmental level. And I have to say that the real danger of climate change is not these sort of abstract things, these sort of like physical things. It's what happens when those physical things hit existing, fragile, interconnected political systems. And I think that it's far more likely that we have that climate change causes war. And that's like where this doom and gloom scenario really is, more so than it is these more abstract things where we see something that might happen 50 years from now. We could be in one of these climate catastrophes tomorrow. So the second part of your question is what we can do is we need to start recognizing that these events are related to the climate, right? We actually have to change the narrative to say, look, we have a heat wave here. Look, we have outrageous wildfires in the West Coast of America. Look, all of these things happen and we notice that they're happening more frequently. I think anyone who has a newspaper subscription knows that these things are happening more frequently. We need to pair that with the idea that this is actually climate change, and that when we see these political fallouts happen, we need to say, look, we need to operate on two levels at once. We need to address the climate and we need to address politics.
Well, climate change has wrecked many ancient civilizations, from Viking Greenland to the Neo-Syrian Empire, with canals drying up. And this, I think, gives people a lot to think about of how modern day political systems can be affected as well. And there's a lot more to chew on here. And for listeners who want to check out your book, the name of it is The Vortex, A True Story of History's Deadliest Storm, An Unspeakable War, and Liberation. Scott, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a blast.
All right. That is all for today. If you'd like to see show notes for this episode and all my other episodes, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that this show is a part of, along with other great history shows like Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and other shows as well. If you'd like to support this show, there are two easy ways to do so. The first is to subscribe to History Unplugged on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second thing is to join the show's membership program. It's on Patreon, and if you go to patreon.com/unplugged and join it, as a member, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the show's entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplugged. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.